Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. First published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. First one-third of Part 3. The Incompetence of the National Assembly. I have taken a view of what has been done by the governing power in France. I have certainly spoken of it with freedom. Those whose principle it is to despise the ancient, permanent sense of mankind, and to set up a scheme of society on new principles, must naturally expect that those of us who don't think as well of their judgment as we do of the human races should consider them and their schemes as being on trial. They avow their hostility to opinion. Of course, they must expect no support from that influence, which they have deposed from the seat of its jurisdiction, along with every other authority. I can never regard this assembly as anything but a voluntary association of men who have availed themselves of circumstances to seize the power of the state. They do not have the sanction and authority of the character under which they first met. They have assumed another very different character, and have completely altered and inverted all the relations in which they originally stood. The authority they exercise is not backed by any constitutional law of the state. They have departed from the instructions of the people by whom they were sent, though those instructions were the sole source of their authority, because the assembly did not act in virtue of any ancient usage or settled law. Their most considerable acts have not been done by great majorities. If they had set up this new experimental government as a necessary substitute for an expelled tyranny, mankind would look ahead to the time of prescription, which through long usage mellows into legality, governments that started in violence. All those whose feelings lead them to the conservation of civil order would recognize as legitimate, even in its cradle, the child produced by that force of necessity to which all just governments owe their birth, and on which they justify their continuance. But they will be slow and reluctant in giving any sort of acceptance to the operations of a power that derived its birth from no law and no necessity, but which, on the contrary, had its origin in the vices and sinister practices by which the social union is often disturbed and sometimes destroyed. This assembly has hardly a year's prescription. They say they have made a revolution. To make a revolution is to subvert the previous state of our country, and extraordinary reasons are needed to justify such a violent proceeding. The sense of mankind authorizes us to examine how the new power is acquired, and to criticize how it is used, with less awe and reverence than is usually granted to a settled and recognized authority. The principles on which the assembly obtained and secured their power are flatly opposite to those that appear to direct them in how they use it. Everything they have done to obtain and keep their power is by the most common arts. Trace them through all their artifices, frauds, and violences, and you'll find nothing new. They follow precedents and examples with the punctilious exactness of an advocate in a law court. They never depart an iota from the authentic formulas of tyranny and usurpation, but their spirit in all the regulations concerning the public good has been the very reverse of this. There they commit the whole populace to the mercy of untested speculations. They abandon the public's dearest interests to set loose theories to which none of them would trust any of his private concerns. Why this difference? Well, in obtaining and securing power, they travel in the beaten road, because they are thoroughly in earnest about that. They abandon the public interests wholly to chance, because they do not really care about them. I say to chance, because there is no empirical evidence that their schemes are likely to be beneficial. We must always see, with a pity mixed with respect, the errors of those who are timid and doubtful of themselves in matters concerning the happiness of mankind. But in these gentlemen, There is nothing of the tender, parental solicitude that fears to cut up the infant for the sake of an experiment. In the vastness of their promises, and the confidence of their predictions, they far outdo all the boasting of hucksters selling fake medicine. The arrogance of their claims provokes and challenges us to inquire into their foundation. Learning from difficulties. I am convinced that there are men of considerable ability among the popular leaders in the National Assembly. Some of them display eloquence in their speeches and their writings, which is not possible without powerful and cultivated talents. But eloquence can exist without a corresponding degree of wisdom. What they have done toward the support of their system indicates that they are no ordinary men. In the system itself, taken as the plan for a republic constructed for procuring the prosperity and security of the citizen, and for promoting the strength and grandeur of the state, I cannot find anything that displays the work of a comprehensive and organizing mind, or even the provisions of mere everyday prudence. Their purpose everywhere seems to have been to evade and slip aside from difficulty. It has been the glory of the great masters in all the arts and sciences to confront difficulties and overcome them. When they had overcome the first difficulty, they turned it into an instrument for new conquests over new difficulties, thus enabling them to extend the scope of their science and even to push forward, beyond the reach of their original thoughts, the landmarks of the human understanding itself. Difficulty is a severe instructor, set over us by God, who knows us better than we know ourselves, as he loves us better too. As Virgil wrote, "The Father himself did not want the ploughman's way to be easy." He that wrestles with us strengthens our nerves and sharpens our skill. Our antagonist is our helper. This amicable conflict with difficulty obliges us to an intimate acquaintance with our object, and compels us to consider it in all its relations. It will not allow us to be superficial. What has created governments with arbitrary powers in so many parts of the world is the lack of nerves of understanding for such a task, the degenerate fondness for fallacious shortcuts. They have created the recent arbitrary monarchy of France. They have created the arbitrary Republic of Paris. With them, defects and wisdom are to be made up for by an abundance of force. They get nothing by it. Commencing their labours on a principle of sloth, they have the common fortune of slothful men. The difficulties that they had dodged, rather than escaped, meet them again down the road. They multiply and thicken on them. They are involved through a labyrinth of confused detail, in an industry without limit and without direction, and eventually the whole of their work becomes feeble, vicious, and insecure. This inability to wrestle with difficulty is what has obliged the arbitrary Assembly of France to start their schemes of reform with abolition and total destruction. Skill is not displayed in destroying and pulling down. Your mob can do this at least as well as your assemblies. The errors and defects of old establishments are visible and palpable. It calls for little ability to point them out. And where absolute power is given, it requires only a word to abolish the defects and the establishment together. When the politicians start to work on filling the place of what they have destroyed, they are directed by the same lazy but restless disposition that loves sloth and hates quiet. To make everything the reverse of what they have seen is, so they think, quite as easy as to destroy. No difficulties occur in what has never been tried. Criticism is almost baffled in discovering the defects of what has not existed, and eager enthusiasm and cheating hope have all the wide field of imagination in which they can hold forth with little or no opposition. Reform. Reforming something, while keeping it in existence, is quite another thing. When the useful parts of an old establishment are kept, and what is added is to be fitted to what is retained, this requires the use of a vigorous mind, steady, persevering attention, various powers of comparison and combination, and the resources of an understanding that is fruitful in expedients. These are to be exercised in a continued conflict with the combined force of two opposite vices, the obstinacy that doesn't want to improve anything, and the light-mindedness that is discontented with everything. You may object, a process of this kind is slow, it is not fit for an assembly that glories in performing in a few months the work of ages. Such a mode of reforming, as you recommend, might take up many years. Without question it might, and it ought. When a method has time as one of its assistants, one of its excellences is that its operation is slow, and in some cases almost imperceptible. If circumspection and caution are a part of wisdom when we work on inanimate matter, surely they become a part of duty also when the subject of our demolition and construction is not brick and timber, but multitudes of sentient beings who may be rendered miserable by the sudden alteration of their state, condition, and habits. It seems as if the prevalent opinion in Paris is that the sole qualifications for a perfect legislator are undoubting confidence and an unfeeling heart. My ideas of that high office are far different. The true lawgiver ought to have a heart full of sensibility. He ought to love and respect his kind, and to fear himself. He may catch his final goal with an intuitive glance, but his movements towards it ought to be deliberate. Political arrangement, being a work for social ends, is to be done only by social means. To produce all the good we aim at requires a union of minds, and that takes time. Our patience will achieve more than our force. If I may appeal to something that is so much out of fashion in Paris, I mean to experience. I will tell you that in the course of my life, I have known and, to the best of my ability, cooperated with great men, and I have never yet seen any plan that was not improved by the observation of people who were much inferior in understanding to the person who took the lead in the business. By a slow but well-sustained progress, the effect of each step is watched. The good or ill success of the first step throws light on the second, and so, from light to light, we are safely conducted through the whole series. We see that the parts of the system do not clash. The evils latent in the most promising contrivances are provided for as they arise. One advantage is as little as possible sacrificed to another. We compensate, we reconcile, we balance. We are enabled to unite into a consistent whole the various anomalies and contending principles that are found in the minds and affairs of men. What arises from this is not excellence in simplicity, but something far superior, excellence in composition. Where the great interests of mankind are concerned through a long series of generations, that series ought to be admitted into some share in the counsels that are going to affect them so deeply. It's not merely that justice requires this. The work itself requires the aid of more minds than one age can provide. It is from this view of things that the best legislators have often been satisfied with the establishment of some sure, solid, and ruling principle in government, and having fixed the principle, they have then left it to its own operation. To proceed in this way, with a presiding principle and a prolific energy, is for me the criterion of profound wisdom. What your politicians take to be the marks of a bold, hardy genius are only proofs of a deplorable lack of ability. By their violent haste and their defiance of the process of nature, they are delivered over blindly to every projector and adventurer, to every alchemist and quack. Your legislators seem to have taken their opinions of all professions, ranks, and offices from the declamations and buffooneries of satirists. By listening only to these, your leaders regard all things only on the side of their vices and faults, and view those vices and faults under every colour of exaggeration. And those who are habitually employed in finding and displaying faults are generally unqualified for the work of reform, because their minds are not furnished with patterns of the fair and good, and also because, by habit, they come to take no delight in the contemplation of such things. By hating vices too much, they come to love men too little. So it is no wonder that they should be disinclined to serve them and unable to do so. From this arises the disposition of some of your guides to pull everything into pieces. As for the others, the paradoxes that eloquent writers have brought forth purely as a sport of fancy to try their talents, to attract attention and excite surprise, are taken up by these gentlemen not in the spirit of the original authors, as means of cultivating their taste and improving their style, but as serious grounds of action on the basis of which they proceed in regulating the most important concerns of the state. Cicero has fun describing Cato as trying to act in the Commonwealth on the basis of school paradoxes that exercise the wits of the junior students in the Stoic philosophy. If this was true of Cato, these gentlemen copy him in the manner of some of his contemporaries. Mr. Hume told me that he had from Rousseau himself the secret of his principles of composition. That acute, though eccentric, observer had perceived that to strike and interest the public, something marvellous must be produced, that the marvellous of the heathen mythology had lost its effect, that the giants, magicians, fairies, and heroes of romance which followed were no longer credible, that now nothing was left to the writer but the kind of marvel that might still be produced, and with as great an effect as ever, namely, the marvellous in life, in manners, in characters, and in extraordinary situations, giving rise to new strokes in politics and morals. I believe that if Rousseau were alive, and in one of his lucid intervals, he would be shocked at the practical frenzy of his scholars, who in their paradoxes are servile imitators, and even in their incredulity reveal an implicit faith. The physician of the state, who undertakes not only to cure illnesses, but to regenerate constitutions, ought to show uncommon powers. Some very unusual appearances of wisdom ought to display themselves on the face of the designs of those who make no appeal to past practice and do not copy any model. Has any such been manifested? I shall survey what the assembly has done with regard to the constitution of the legislature, to that of the executive power, to that of the judicature, to the model of the army, and finally to the system of finance, to see whether we can discover in any part of their schemes the awesome ability that might justify them in the superiority they assume over mankind. The Constitution of the Legislature. Old establishments are tested by their effects. If the people are happy, united, wealthy, and powerful, we presume the rest. We conclude something to be good, if good comes from it. In old establishments, various correctives have been found for their departures from theory. Indeed, those establishments are the results of various necessities and expediencies. They are not often constructed on the basis of any theory. Rather, theories are drawn from them. In them we often see that the best way to the goal is through means that seem not to be perfectly consistent with what we originally planned. The means taught by experience react back on the original constitution, and sometimes bring improvements to the design they seem to have departed from. An example of this is the British Constitution. The errors and deviations of every kind are found and computed, and the ship proceeds on its way. This is the case of old establishments, but in a new and merely theoretic system, every contrivance is expected to appear, on the face of it, to be right for its purpose, especially when those who are launching it are in no way constrained by attempts to accommodate the new building to an old one, either in the walls or on the foundations. The French builders, clearing away as mere rubbish whatever they found, and putting everything onto an exact level, proposed to rest the whole local and general legislature on bases of three different kinds. One, geometrical, which they call the basis of territory. one arithmetical, the basis of population, and one financial, the basis of contribution. For purposes of bringing in territory, they divide their country into 6,400 square districts called cantons. In the old divisions of the country, the boundaries were fixed by various accidents at various times, and by the ebb and flow of various properties and jurisdictions. These boundaries were not made on any fixed system, and they involved inconveniences, but use had found remedies for these, and habit had enabled people to put up with them patiently. In this new pavement of squares, this organization based on geometry and not on any political principle, there are bound to be countless local inconveniences to which men are not habituated. But these I pass over, because to specify them requires an accurate knowledge of the country, which I do not have. These state surveyors soon found that in politics the most fallacious of all things was geometrical demonstration. They then resorted to another buttress to support the building that was tottering on that false foundation. It was evident that the goodness of the soil, the number of the people, their wealth, and the largeness of their contribution made so much difference between one square and another that sheer size was a ridiculous standard of power in the Commonwealth. However, they could not give it up. Instead, they divided their political and civil representation into three parts, and allotted one of those parts to the square measurement, without a single fact or calculation, to settle whether this territorial proportion of representation was fairly assigned. Anyway, arbitrarily giving one-third to geometry, they left the other two-thirds to be scuffled for between the other parts, population and contribution. When they came to provide for population, they could not proceed quite as smoothly as they had done in the field of their geometry. Here, their arithmetic came to bear on their juridical metaphysics. If they had stuck to their metaphysical principles, the arithmetical process would have been simple. They hold that all men are strictly equal and entitled to equal rights in their own government. Each head on this system would have its vote, and every man would vote directly for the person who was to represent him in the legislature. But that is not what their metaphysics dictated. First, each canton has a primary assembly, and an inhabitant of a canton must pay to be allowed to be a member of his primary assembly, the fee being equal to 3 days' pay in his locality. This excludes from a vote the man whose natural equality stands the most in need of protection and defence. I mean the man who cannot afford the qualifying payment, and so has nothing but his natural equality to guard him. You order him to buy the right of which you had earlier told him that nature had given it to him free, at his birth, and that no authority on earth could lawfully deprive him of it. Each canton is part of a set of such cantons called a commune, which is also square. The primary assemblies of the cantons elect deputies to their commune, one for every 200 qualified inhabitants. Here, a second toll gate is fixed. To be elected as a deputy to the commune, a person must pay the amount of 10 days' labour. These communes choose deputies to the department of which the commune is a part, and the deputies of the department choose their deputies to the National Assembly. Here is a third barrier of a senseless qualification. Every deputy to the National Assembly must pay a direct contribution with the value of a mark of silver. In all this process, which in its fundamental elements purports to consider only population on a principle of natural right, there is a manifest attention to property, and this, however just and reasonable on other schemes, is perfectly indefensible on theirs. And when they come to their third basis, contribution, we find that they have more completely lost sight of their rights of men. This last basis rests entirely on property, thus admitting a principle totally different from the equality of men, and utterly irreconcilable to it. The Committee of Constitution virtually admit that they are wholly irreconcilable, and their way of dealing with this is a confused and unprincipled use of arithmetic, replacing the geometry used to carve up the country. Treating France like a conquered country. You cannot help seeing that this scheme cuts France up into a variety of republics, totally independent of each other, and with no direct constitutional means of coherence, connection, or subordination, except what can come from their going along with the decisions of the General Congress of the ambassadors from each independent republic. That is what the National Assembly really is. Such governments do indeed exist in the world, though in forms more suitable to their people's locations and customs. But such associations, not really political bodies, have generally been the effect of necessity, not choice. And I believe the present French power is the very first body of citizens who, having obtained full authority to do with their country what they pleased, have chosen to cut it up in this barbarous manner. These pretended citizens treat France exactly like a conquered country. The policy of barbarous victors, who contemn a subdued people and insult their feelings, has always been as much as possible to destroy all vestiges of the former country in religion, in polity, in laws, and in manners, to confound all territorial limits, to produce general poverty, to put up their properties for auction, to crush their princes, nobles, and pontiffs, to lay low everything that could serve to combine or rally the distressed and disbanded people under the standard of old opinion. They have made France free in the way the Romans, those sincere friends of the rights of mankind, freed Greece, Macedon, and other nations. They destroyed the bonds of their union on the pretense of providing for the independence of each of their cities. When the members who compose these new bodies of cantons, communes, and departments, arrangements purposely produced through the medium of confusion, begin to act, they will find themselves in a great measure strangers to one another. The electors, and elected throughout, especially in the rural cantons, will be frequently without any civil habitudes or connections, or any of the natural discipline that is the soul of a true republic. Magistrates and collectors of revenue are now no longer acquainted with their districts, or bishops with their dioceses, or curates with their parishes. These new colonies of the rights of men bear a strong resemblance to the sort of military colonies that Tacitus commented on in the declining policy of Rome. In this, as in almost everything, your new commonwealth is born and bred and fed in the corruptions that mark degenerated and worn-out republics. Your child comes into the world with the symptoms of death. The legislators who formed the ancient republics knew that their business was too arduous to be accomplished with no better apparatus than the metaphysics of an undergraduate and the arithmetic of a tax collector. They had to do with men, and were obliged to study human nature. They had to do with citizens, and were obliged to study the effects of the habits formed by the circumstances of civil life. They were aware that the operation of this second nature on the first produced a new combination, and from that arose many diversities among men, according to their birth, their education, their professions, the lengths of their lives, their residence in towns or in the country, their various ways of acquiring and settling property, and according to the quality of the property itself, all of which made them so many different species of animals, as it were. So they thought themselves obliged to sort their citizens into classes, to give them political situations appropriate to their particular habits, and to give them privileges that might provide each class with force to protect itself in the conflicts caused by the diversity of interests that must exist and must quarrel in any complex society. The legislator would have been ashamed if the coarse husbandman knew how to sort and to use his sheep, horses, and oxen, and had enough common sense not to abstract and equalize them all into mere animals in general, without providing for each kind an appropriate food, care, and employment, while he, the economist, disposer and shepherd of his own kindred, elevating himself into an airy metaphysician, was resolved to know nothing of his flocks except as men in general. That is why Montesquieu remarked very justly that the great legislators of antiquity made the greatest display of their powers, and even soared above themselves in their classification of the citizens. It is here that your modern legislators have sunk even below their own nothing. As the first sort of legislators attended to the different kinds of citizens, and combined them into one commonwealth, the others, the metaphysical and alchemistic legislators, have taken the directly opposite course. They have done their best to run all sorts of citizens together into one homogeneous mass, and then they divided this mass of theirs into a number of incoherent republics. They reduce men to loose counters, merely for the sake of simple counting, and not to figures whose power is to arise from their place on the table. They have levelled and crushed together all the orders that they found, even under the coarse, unartificial arrangement of the monarchy, where the classifying of the citizens is less important than it is in a republic. But every such classification, if properly ordered, is good in all forms of government. It creates a strong barrier against the excesses of despotism, and is needed to give effect and permanence to a republic. For lack of something of this kind, if the present project of a republic should fail, all the indirect restraints that mitigate despotism are removed, so that if monarchy ever again obtains an entire ascendancy in France, unless it is tempered from the outset by the wise and virtuous counsels of the monarch, it will probably be the most completely arbitrary power ever seen on earth. This is to play a most desperate game. They even declare that one of their objectives is the confusion that comes with all such proceedings. They hope to secure their constitution by fear of a return of the evils that came with their making it. By this, they say, its destruction will become difficult for any authority which cannot break it up without entirely disorganizing the whole state. They are assuming that if this takeover authority ever came to have as much power as they have acquired, it would make a more moderate use of it, and would be reluctant to entirely disorganize the state in the savage manner that they have done. They look to the virtues of returning despotism for the security that is to be enjoyed by the offspring of their popular vices. Consequences of the fragmenting of France. I wish, sir, that you and my readers would attend carefully to the work of Monsieur de Calonne on this subject. It is eloquent, able, and instructive. Pay special attention to the explicit announcement that he refers to, made by one of the principal leaders in the assembly, concerning the tendency of their scheme to bring France not only from a monarchy to a republic, but from a republic to a mere confederacy. It adds new force to my observations. And indeed, Monsieur de Calonne's work makes up for my deficiencies by many new and striking arguments on most of the subjects of this letter. Their difficulties and contradictions have mainly arisen from this resolution to break their country into separate republics. If it were not for this, the representation, though derived from parts, would be a duty that equally concerned the whole. Each deputy to the assembly would be the representative of France, and of all its kinds, of the many and the few, of the rich and the poor, of the great districts and the small. All these districts would themselves be subordinate to some standing authority that existed independently of them. This government, standing, unalterable and fundamental, is the only thing that could make that territory truly and properly a whole. In Great Britain, when electing popular representatives, we send them to a council, the House of Commons, in which each man individually is a subject and submitted to a government that is complete in all its ordinary functions. This government is the point of reference of the various members and districts of our representation, the centre of our unity, a trustee for the whole and not for the parts. So is the other branch of our public council, I mean the House of Lords. With us the King and the Lords are several and joint securities for the equality of each district, each province, each city. When did you hear of any province in Great Britain suffering from the inequality of its representation, or from having no representation at all? Not only our monarchy and our peerage secure the equality on which our unity depends, but it is the spirit of the House of Commons itself. Your new constitution is the very reverse of ours in its principle, and I am astonished that anyone could offer anything done in it as an example for Great Britain. With you there is little connection, actually no connection, between the last representative and the first constituent. The member who goes to the National Assembly is not chosen by the people or accountable to them. There are three elections before he is chosen. Two sets of magistracy intervene between him and the primary assembly, so as to make him, I repeat, an ambassador of a state, and not a representative of the people within a state. The whole spirit of the election is changed by this, and no corrective devised by your constitution mongers can make him anything but what he is. The only way to connect the original constituent with the representative would be by having the candidate apply in the first instance to the primary electors, so that they might force the two succeeding bodies of electors to make a choice agreeable to their wishes. This would clearly subvert the whole scheme, plunging them back into the tumult and confusion of popular election, which they mean to avoid by their interposed gradation of elections. It would eventually put the whole fortune of the state in the hands of those who have the least knowledge of it and the least interest in it. This is a perpetual dilemma that they are thrown into by the vicious, weak, and contradictory principles they have chosen. Unless the people break up and flatten this gradation, they obviously do not really elect to the Assembly. Indeed, they don't even appear to do so. What are we all looking for in an election? To meet its real purposes, you must first be able to know the fitness of your man, and then you must retain some hold on him by personal obligation or dependence. What can the primary electors in your system be looking for? They can never know anything of the qualities of the person who is to serve them, nor has he any obligation to them. In case of abuse, your body of primary electors never can call the representative to an account for his conduct. He is too distant from them in the chain of representation. If he acts improperly, at the end of his 2 years' term, it does not concern him for 2 years more. By the new French constitution, the best and the wisest representatives go equally with the worst into this set-aside status. Their hulls are supposed to have barnacles, so they must go into dock to be refitted. Every man who was served in an assembly is ineligible for 2 years after. Just as these magistrates begin to learn their trade, they are disqualified for exercising it. This set-aside interval is not unfavourable to a faithless representative, who may be as good a canvasser as he was a bad governor. In this time, he may plot his way into a superiority over the wisest and most virtuous. All the members of this elective constitution are equally fleeting, and exist only for the election, so the persons who originally chose him may be quite different from the ones to whom he is to be responsible when he asks for a renewal of his trust. To call all the secondary electors of the commune to account is ridiculous, impracticable, and unjust. They may themselves have been deceived in their choice. As the third set of electors, those of the department may be in theirs. In your elections, responsibility cannot exist. End of the first one-third of Part 3.